We've been having a series of talks over the last few months about the fundamental teachings in the Vipassana path. We've talked about the first three noble truths, understanding deeply where suffering comes from, that it's possible to live without it. And the fourth noble truth, which is what we're working with now, the Eightfold Path, we're starting with the traditional starting place of wisdom, which is right view or understanding these things deeply. And then the second part of that is right thinking or right intention, which is all the outflow of heart and mind that come from that understanding. And, you know, one of the hardest, most difficult things that we find when we start this path, all along this path, really any path, is the ways we fall short. The ways we don't do the things we want to do. In fact, I can't tell you how many times I've watched myself doing it just as I have the intention not to do it. You know, don't make that snarky remark as it's coming out of my mouth. You know, follow this negative ill will thing that's in your heart, and then there it is. You know, or I say or do something that, and it inevitably brings conflict, right? It inevitably brings kind of that feeling that you feel, ugh. And without understanding this, it usually leads us to a place, especially in our culture, where we feel like we're not good enough, we feel deficient, we feel kind of like imposters, like we're doing this practice, but we don't actually expect to get anywhere with it. And I want to look at this from the Eightfold Path of right view and right intention. And because in reality, things are going exactly how they're supposed to for each one of us, no matter what it looks like. However this is unfolding for you is exactly the right way. What gets in our way of it is we carry around a lot of self-beliefs and self-images that get in the way. So it's not that there's anything wrong with what's going on. It's just that we've got these beliefs and images that cause us to suffer. One of the ways this is articulated is we all carry around an internalized ego ideal, which is how we imagine ourselves to live when we've mastered all this, right? Life is going to be great. I will never feel my heart sink when I listen to the news or think about, like, oh, my neighbor bothers me, or, you know, we have this ideal in our minds of how life is going to be, right, when we're at the place that we imagine perfection is. And so every time life bumps along, because the first noble truth is life has the quality of dukkha, it's bumpy and uneven. Every time that happens, this mistaken belief makes us think it's about us, not about life. And so we internalize that as a failure. And the other mistaken belief we carry around is called the ideal ego, which is who we think that with this idea that we have of what the awakened person looks like, or what a spiritual community should be like. We should not have conflict. You know, I should be a certain way, and we carry that in everything in our life. You know, our family should be a certain way. We're coming up on Thanksgiving. You know, if only my family, you know, their politics were different, or Uncle Joe wasn't such a, you know, didn't go on and hog all the conversation. We think, you know, we have this ideal of who we think not only our spiritual practice, but our lives. My marriage would be great if it weren't for my partner. You know, my meditation would be great if it weren't for my mind. You know, everything we do. My job would be great if it weren't for my boss. I mean, we see everything in terms of an ideal of what we think it should be. And then when it doesn't measure up, we think something's wrong. Stephen Pope, whose book I pulled off the shelf this last week thinking about this, his book is called The Wisdom of Yoga, talks about this, and he had a funny line. He He said, after you learn the Four Noble Truths, he said, then there's the first noble failure. Universal, you know? And the fact is, it's not a failure, it's a process. When we think about these beliefs we carry, I'm inadequate, I'm deficient, I mess up all the time, I fall short. I was thinking it's actually not an unhelpful thing to apply Byron Katie's four questions to this for those of you who are aware of her work. So let's take the belief, I am not good enough. And the first question is that true? Is that true? And if you answer yes to that, then the second question is it really true? Do you absolutely know that that is the case? And then the third question is, who am I? What happens to me when I believe the belief I am not good enough? What happens inside? Right? We become depressed, closed, the heart shrinks, stressful. And then the fourth question would be, who would I be if I didn't have that belief? Who would you be if you didn't carry the belief with you that you were messing up or you were not good enough? Who would you be? And her point is, you can't drop these beliefs because they're what we believe. That's what we've been taught. But we can examine them. And the radical premise of Vipassana practice is that deeper, clearer seeing, the awareness of deeper, clearer seeing is really all that we need to wake up, to stop our suffering. So let's try that one out. Let's see if that works. So I want to make some points that come from Panna about this. And the first one is, there's a traditional Dharma teaching in the called the teaching of conceit. And the teaching of conceit isn't being stuck on yourself. It's thinking that you could be different than who you are, that you could be different in some way, you know? And if I could be different in some way, I would be a lot funnier, you know? I would never put things off, you know? I would call my mom more often. I mean, you know, I would be taller. I mean, but the fact is, as we start to do our practices, we've all noticed in insight practice, do you choose your thoughts? No, they just come up, right? Do you choose your emotional reactions to things? If you did choose them, we'd be insane. Who would choose the kinds of things that we feel a lot of the time? We don't choose these things. And in meditation, when we see them, we realize, wow, all this stuff comes to us. It's called causes and conditions by our cultures, our families, our ages, our backgrounds, our experiences in life. So part of it is, you could not be different than who you are. That's a mistaken idea. And the corollary to this that I think we carry around in practice is that we think, I need to be different in order to get this meditation right, in order to, you know, bring tranquility to my life, or bring deeper peace and compassion to my life. So we think we need to be someone different. You know, I need to fix myself in some way. I need to make my mind, I need to get my concentration better, or I need to be in a different place. That's why I'm sitting. That's a corollary to this mistaken belief that things could be different than how they are. And this path is not about self-improvement. It's not about fixing. It's not about changing. It's about making friends with who we are already. And the first book somebody put in my hands 30 years ago that started me on this path was Pema Chodron's The Wisdom of No Escape. It's an early book she wrote, obviously over 30 years ago. And in it, the first chapter, which hooked me and has never unhooked me, is thinking you need to be different in some way to have what your heart wants is a violent attitude to take towards oneself. it's an attitude of aggression towards oneself. And that you can do this practice and still be crazy, still be worried, still be, you know, not looking forward to the Thanksgiving consolation of your family or whatever it is. This practice is about seeing the ways that we check out, we numb out, we avoid. Sometimes we do things the way we want to. Sometimes it doesn't go. Of seeing that whole full catastrophe as friends to ourselves, as with compassion to ourselves. This is what being a human being is. And so we come as we are, and we stay as we are in this practice. There's no need to be different in any way, but by sitting and seeing these processes clearly and with compassion, the awareness that experiences your life, which is who you truly are. You're not your thoughts and feelings. You're not your bodies. Vipassana practice, the point of it is to show us that clearly. You realize that awareness, just sitting in the awareness that can see it, the awareness itself will make any changes that will happen to make your life flow the way that it, you know, that your heart wants. It's not about the small me fixing. So we come as we are, and we stay as we are. And there's a magic in stopping fighting who we are. There's a magic in that of just going, okay, here's what we got. Here's what we have. And to look at that with curiosity and kindness. And the other thing is this is practice. We don't come to it to be good the first time or even the 100th time we do things. Any of you who have learned to play a musical instrument, I mean, how many years of doing scales do you have to do before you can play the piece that when I learned to play piano, I wanted to play Clair de Lune. You know, I didn't get it the first 5 years, 10 years, right? I mean, it's practice. And I remember when I was learning to play the guitar, and I asked a friend of mine who's a really good guitarist, like, how many times do I have to make these chords? Like, okay, you know, where you're manually putting the fingers on the strings before they'll just make those chords by themselves. How long does it take? How many times do I have to do this? And his answer was, enough. Enough times. That's our practice here. You know, you find yourself tending to lose it when you get stuck in traffic. How many times do you have to be in traffic before the awareness can go, wow, there's a lot of irritation here, which is a really different place than just being stuck in it. How many times do we do enough? Enough times. So giving ourselves the respect of understanding that these things take time. And the other thing that's really important about this process, and that any therapist will tell you, you can only see clearly and let the awareness make any adjustments and skillful response that are needed to the extent you can stay with the discomfort that any kind of shift in patterns brings. Do you know what I'm talking about there? Because part of it feels different, and part of it is seeing the places in ourselves that need attention. It's not an easy process. And we can do it to the extent that we can stay with the discomfort, both in ourselves and also the change back messages we tend to get from our environment. So we've got a lot of factors here. So in summary, this whole thing, these images we carry about who we should be and what the world should be, and then we fall short of them and we blame ourselves, is another way, we're coming back to the second noble truth. There's nothing wrong with us. The suffering comes from we resist who we are. Oh, no, I shouldn't be this way. Oh, I should be more this way. I'm a terrible conversationalist at cocktail parties. That should be different. It's like, nope, that's what it is. And so because we resist who we already are, that's why we suffer. That's a radical concept, isn't it? It's a radical concept. So in this situation, a practice like metta, which is integral to the Vipassana path, can be your best friend. And let me just do a short little thing on metta, because I realize not everyone may do metta practice. But it is a practice, you can do it with the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, sympathetic joy. It's about bringing the act of loving kindness or compassion home to yourself, and then you extend it out. And I'm going to recommend that you do it for yourself, which is traditionally where we start. And usually it's done that you sit. It's a great way to start your practice, that you sit and, in fact, let's just sit and do this for 5 minutes. You sit, and just like we started the sitting, you notice the mind, the body, the heart you've got right now, which may have dents in it, right? There may be places where there's sort of sad places or empty places. And you start by seeing that. You start by saying, I know I have suffered. I've lost things that were really important to me, or I'm experiencing a lot of illness and it's really difficult, or I really wanted this to happen and it didn't happen. I feel disconnected. I want to give and receive love and I feel cut off from that. To really acknowledge whatever the mind and the body and the heart you have right now, to see it. There it is. To really connect with those places that feel suffering. And then from that innately open place in the heart that can even see the suffering, to offer yourself kindness and compassion. May I have ease of being. May I feel content. May I feel like I can give and receive love. May I clearly see the right response in this situation. May I be present with my own suffering and thus the suffering of those around me. May I be at peace. And then whatever, those are just some sample suggestions for yourself. So just continue for a moment, offering yourself whatever your heart wants right now. Peace, connectedness, lightheartedness, beauty, love. Thank you. That's a lovely way. And then in the traditional practice, you extend it to someone you love, to someone who's just kind of casual in your life, you don't know, and then to somebody you have a difficult time with. But just doing it, we start with ourselves because we can only extend this out to the extent that we can feel it for ourselves first. So I would really try this as good medicine for the heart, good medicine for the self. So some principles of Pana on this place of feeling self-deficient is one of the teachings in Pana is to stop trusting what you think. And it doesn't say this in the sutras, but I think by corollary, what you believe. Getting back to when we carry certain beliefs along, the way they make us feel, and realizing it's our beliefs that make us suffer. So stop trusting what you think, and what you think comes from what you believe. Lou had bought a t-shirt years ago that had a picture of the Buddha, and it said, don't believe everything you think. I would say, don't believe hardly for anything you think. And the point in the suttas is that all thinking is wrong thinking because it is thinking. And thinking comes from a limited viewpoint perspective. Because wherever there's perception, we are taught a description of the world that includes that we feel separated. We don't feel our oneness. that fundamental delusion colors and distorts all of our thinking. So all thinking is wrong thinking because it is thinking. And it doesn't mean like, you know, you have to trash your mind, but it's just when things come up, you just take it with a grain of salt. And the metaphor that's been coming up to me these last couple of weeks and thinking about this is the six blind men looking at the elephant. And I think I might have talked about this a couple of weeks ago. So you've got six blind men, and they're trying to describe what an elephant is, and none of them have seen an elephant before. And one blind man happens to get a hold of the tusk and says, it's smooth, and it's cylindrical, and it's, you know. And then another one is holding onto the leg, and he said, no, it's a pillar. It's a pillar. And then another one is at the side and says, no, it's a wall. It's a wall that's breathing. This is like our thinking. Are any of them wrong? No. But do any of them have the truth? No. So that's what our thinking is. It comes from our particular causes and conditions. So it's not wrong in terms of, you know, but it's not the truth either because it's limited. So and part of this, you know, unbidden thinking, which is what comes up in our meditation and actually in our lives all the time, the thoughts that just come without our thinking, oh, I need to work on this report now. It's just all the stuff that comes up, all the monkey mind stuff that comes up. It's very draining, isn't it? And the other thing is when we use that kind of mind to try to solve something, it usually doesn't work that well. You ever tried to figure out whether you should change your job or whether this relationship is going to go well, and you think it out, and it just, the wheels turn and turn and turn, but it doesn't actually get anywhere, does it? It's kind of an endless cycle. This is part of not trusting your thinking. When you find this happening, or your images about yourself, the instructions just to abandon it. Not follow the outflow. In my life, one of the things that I've learned from this path is when I have a situation that, you know, it's a tricky situation, it's not obvious, like how many plates to put out for dinner. If I wait in awareness, at some point when that solution comes, and this happens to all of us, it comes fully formed, right? We just suddenly know what to do. Or we know how to address something, or we know if this job is right, or if this relationship is right, or if this decision is right. Do you know what I'm talking about? That's what comes from not trusting thinking, not following the squirrel wheel of trying to think things out, but to step back and let something bigger that's more connected guide us. And in that not trusting thinking are all those self-beliefs. So the second thing from Pana that I want to put out there is you don't have as much control as you think. And I'm here just elaborating on what I said earlier. When you realize you don't choose most of your thoughts, you don't choose your emotional reactions, you certainly don't choose what's going on in our body. Lou and I were in bed at 7:30 last night going, how can we be tired this quickly? But that's how it was. We don't have as much agency as we think. And part of this is because the delusion of separateness is that we're conscious beings in control of our lives. We all come from that, right? Self-actualized person, you know. But when you start this practice, it humbles you because you realize how much of what happens comes from the unconscious, right? Things just come up that sometimes feel overpowering. And really, this work isn't about changing what we think and feel, but taking what's unconscious and making it conscious, as Rudolf Steiner said, is the point of any spiritual path. So as we see things more clearly, things begin to adjust. The reactive patterns we know we're in that don't serve us, as we see them more, as they become less unconscious and more conscious, they start to adjust on, seemingly on their own. It's like that mud puddle in the movie Groundhog Day that the guy keeps stepping in. After he's done it enough, one day he sees that the puddle's there and he will never step in it again. That's how this path works. Have you noticed that? That one day you notice that suddenly something that you've always reacted a certain way, one day it's just not there because you've seen it enough. This is about seeing. So in fact, I think about in the time of the Buddha, they called this karma. You know, how, why do some people keep getting in relationships with the wrong people, or they keep doing things in their lives that don't serve them? I think these days we'd call that the unconscious. You know, that seems like karma, but really it comes from not seeing those deeper things that push and pull us. So in Vipassana, seeing clearly and deeply, we see these unskillful patterns in action. We simply notice they're there. We see them. And we understand that they're impersonal. They come from causes and conditions. Every human being's got them. It has nothing to do with our self-worth. And we watch them. And at some point, they just let go. And the other thing is, by seeing how trapped we are in our own patterns, how unconscious we are, it actually opens us to all people, because we realize we're all, every person, every human being on the planet is right here with this stuff. So it actually opens our hearts. And the other thing I wanted to reiterate again that comes from this teaching is that this process of seeing clearly involves discomfort. Seeing things that, you know, are painful, it's hard to see them. And so we have to abide with discomfort. And the more we can see them, the more we can sit with the discomfort of seeing them, the more things start to adjust and flow in our lives. So we come to it with compassion for ourselves and with some kindness. It's not only that we don't have to do this perfectly in order to get the benefits, but there's really no value in doing it perfectly. We learn from just doing it over and over again. And I want to close with a comment about a couple of remarks. One is a quote by Bhante Gunaratana about mindfulness, which is the root of our practice. And he says, mindfulness gives you time. Time gives you choices. And I would put in the word seeing here. Mindfulness gives you seeing. Seeing gives you choices. Choices, skillfully made, lead to freedom. You don't have to be swept away by your feeling. You can respond with wisdom and kindness rather than habit and reactivity. So this whole practice is about seeing more deeply, with the understanding that seeing gives us more space and more time. And with that, we find that everything that we've needed has been in us all along. We haven't needed to be different at all. We just need to see it, to keep it company. So right view includes knowing our patterning, our perceptions, our reactivity, all the patterns that we outflow, and all the ways that we miss our intentions, we miss the mark, and embracing that. Not beating it up, not fixing it, embracing it. This is the path. And we do this with kindness and with compassion. And with right intention, we see what's coming up from moment to moment. We're more likely to catch the little constrictions and the difficult feelings and the, oh, I don't want this, in the moment. That gives us time for something bigger to open up that can respond to those things. So right view, to close, is we all carry these ego ideals and the ideal ego. And it's just seeing how that expresses in your heart, in your mind, in your life from moment to moment. I would encourage you to take a look for that. Take a look at that. Because it's that gap between this mistaken belief in perfection and who we actually are. That's where the suffering happens, correct? It's not you. It's this belief, it's this gap between a delusional belief and then your beautiful humanity, which is exactly how it should be.